Commissioner Retardo, Senator Duncan, Senator Courtney. There will be no work sessions today. So that means specifically House Bill 2758, 2805, H.J.R. 2, H.J. 52 are gone from the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, would you please make reference to the quality here, though?
I'll do that. That was under the high state. I don't know. As far as 2985 and 2630, there's a possible work session. They're not going to be working. I don't even know if we're going to publicly hear them, so I have to find out if they're publicly heard yet. But we'll talk about that. Zanke, once you up here, because you're going to be the only one testified on the HJRs, and so that, this is your moment.
Sure. Does the committee have copies of the original Measure 40?
What?
Does the committee have copies of the original Measure 40?
I think
it's helpful to have those out here.
We do. The answer is yes, we do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Sedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on HRs 87 through 94. Like all of you, I have sat through much testimony on these issues, and I do have written testimony that is being distributed. I'm not going to read the written testimony, but rather try to address some issues that I think either have not been directly addressed or need to be emphasized before you move into work session on these resolutions. It has been said that Measure 40 was overturned on a constitutional technicality. I think many of you are aware that the decision in Armada versus Hitzhopper was based on a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU of Oregon. And we filed that lawsuit on behalf of citizens who are law-abiding citizens, not on behalf of those accused of crimes, because we felt Measure 40 affected the rights of all Oregonians in its sweeping language. And in particular, we wanted to highlight the procedural defects in Measure 40. And those procedural defects, we believe, went to the heart of the initiative process. Our Constitution, the fundamental law of our state government, can be amended fairly easily in Oregon. Of the states that have the initiative, only about half allow constitutional amendments by initiative. And of those, Oregon is among the easiest to amend by initiative. And this is particularly troublesome when voters are faced with many issues on a particular ballot. And in November of 1996, they were faced with many issues. The way that Measure 40 was framed made it very difficult for anyone without a lengthy scorecard to figure out what Measure 40 would actually accomplish. That's not fair to voters who want to believe they're making an informed choice, and it's not fair to our system of laws and our Constitution. And I raise that to you because that really is the issue that was at the heart of the Armada case, and it remains the issue with HJRs 87 through 94. Are you going to refer measures to the voters that the voters will understand that they will be able to make an informed decision as to how the Constitution is going to be changed if they vote yes? And this is why, from the beginning of this process, this session, the ACLU has strongly urged the sponsors of Measure 40 and the proponents of first HJR 4 and now HJRs 87 through 94 to focus in on the existing language of the Constitution that is going to be amended. As you heard from Representative Przanski, all but two of these measures will change in dramatic ways existing provisions of the Oregon Constitution. We believe that it's critical that Oregon voters see the language they're changing. In many instances, those changes could be accomplished. And I want to back up a second here. Even though the ACLU may disagree with some of the policy choices that the proponents of Measure 40 want to make to our Constitution, and although we will argue that there are some of those changes that should not be referred to the voters, whatever you refer should be in a form that is clean and easy to understand, both for the sake of the voters and for the sake of future generations of Oregonians. They're going to have to live with this language in their Constitution. The biggest problem with the HJRs as they come to you from the House is that there is surplus language in most of the resolutions that we believe is there for no purpose other than to frame the issue in the context of victims' rights. But as a matter of operative language, whether it would actually make a difference in at least a positive difference in terms of accomplishing those policy objectives, we believe that language gets in the way and will only cause problems down the road and make it more likely that those provisions will be overturned again because of the inherent procedural defect in doing that. And I've said, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in the House, I've said it in the House committee, I've said it in private meetings with the proponents of Measure 40 and these HJRs, that it is, while it may appear to be in the short-term interest of the ACLU to let them move forward with language that contains procedural defects, for after all, we could just go to court and challenge the language again and get it thrown out again. I do not believe that that is in the interest of Oregonians. I don't think it's in the long-term interest of civil liberties in this state. So, again, that is why I think your task, as you move into the next week, of working with the specific language of these measures is critical. Rather than well, there are a few short comments I wanted to make about each particular measure. I may skip some. As you've already heard, I think we're the closest to consensus of any of these resolutions on HJR 87. Everyone, including the ACLU, believes that the interests of crime victims need to be factored into the criminal justice system. They have, in large part, been factored in through statute. We do not object in principle to placing some of those protections in the Constitution. But we do think that you need to be careful in doing that. The discussion you had at the earlier hearing about the issue relating to whether a victim who is a potential witness in a case should actually be allowed to be in the courtroom prior to testifying is, I think, a clear example of how you may be setting up conflicts between the state constitution and the federal constitution. What I heard the proponents of HJR 87 in its current form saying is, well, the federal constitution will take care of that if there's a conflict, and we don't have to worry about it in our constitution. I don't think you should assume that anything is going to be taken care of by the federal constitution. It should be written right the first time. Or the second time, as the case may be, or the third time, if it takes that many times. On H.R. 88, the quote-unquote state right to a jury trial, that section could be accomplished very easily, at least one part of it could be accomplished very easily with the proposed minority report that was rejected in the House. By taking the existing language of Article 1, Section 11, and inserting after the requirement that the defendant cannot waive trial by jury unless the court agrees, just that, and the state. And that would give prosecutors as well as the judge the right to prevent a defendant from waiving their trial by jury. The other section of H.R. 88 that seems to be effective, we think will have no effect, which is the addition of without delay to the Constitution on behalf of, to give a victim the right to a trial without delay. There is currently, and it may surprise you to hear this, in the Oregon Bill of Rights, as far as I can see, no provision that guarantees a defendant the right to a trial without delay. There is a provision that requires all court proceedings to be administered completely and without delay in Article 1, Section 10. That is not limited to criminal defendants. It applies to all court proceedings. We believe it already gives everyone involved in a court case the right to a trial without undue delay. And as you've heard, trials in Oregon are not subject to undue delay. So we think you can drop that language without affecting anything. And by adding it, you create a conflict with the federal Constitution. On H.R. 89, which is the jury composition piece, we agree with the testimony of others that you've heard from. We oppose restricting jury pools to just registered voters. H.R. 90, again, we believe the minority report language in the House would accomplish much of what the proponents want and do it in a way that is cleaner and less subject to constitutional challenge. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about H.R. 91, which is the partial repeal of the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause, because there is some both some problems procedurally, as you heard from the Attorney General's office, with the way that is written, and we believe the policy contained in that resolution is an anathema to the Constitution and a fair system of justice in this state or any other state. And therefore, we don't like the language that the Attorney General has suggested either. And we would urge you to just reject H.J.R. 91 outright and not pass any form of that particular measure. We believe that the lockstep provision, we agree with the Attorney General's office that it would constitute a revision of the Oregon Constitution and therefore would require a two-thirds vote to be approved. But we also believe that it would violate the federal Constitution. When Oregon was admitted to the Union in 1859, it agreed to take on the sovereign power of a state. As you know, the federal government has limited power granted by the federal Constitution, and that grant of power came from the states. We do not believe that a state can give up part of its sovereign authority and abdicate that authority to the federal government, which in essence is what H.R. 91 does by having this lockstep connection to the interpretation of the federal Constitution. In terms of the Attorney General's rewrite of H.R. 91, we believe that also would constitute a revision of the Oregon Constitution and would not pass muster under state constitutional analysis. And the primary reason we believe that is twofold. One, the rationale for the exclusionary rule in Oregon is different than the current rationale used by the U.S. Supreme Court in its exclusionary rule cases. The other reason follow up on that thought. Justice Carson, in a decision, an opinion that he wrote in the case of State versus Davis in 1983, did a very cogent synopsis of the history of the exclusionary rule, both nationally and particularly here in Oregon. Oregon adopted the exclusionary rule shortly after it was adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1914. It was adopted in Oregon in a case called State v. Laundy in 1922. But when the Oregon Court adopted the exclusionary rule, they cited the rationale that had been used by the states of Iowa and Vermont in adopting the exclusionary rule prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Weeks in 1914. The Vermont decision dated from 1901 and the Iowa decision from 1903. The rationale essentially, it was not deterrence. It was not to try to deter improper conduct by law enforcement officials. It was equity between parties in a court proceeding. One party to a court proceeding should not be able to get advantage over another by violating the law. And if, in fact, one party has violated the law, they should be put back into balance as if they had not violated the law. And the only way to do that was to exclude the evidence that had been obtained illegally. That continues to be the reason for the exclusionary rule in Oregon. And even though the U.S. Supreme Court, which for many years used the same rationale, has moved away from that, that does not affect Oregon. And we don't think it should, because we think that reasoning makes sense. Because if you allow one party, particularly where that party is the government, to gain advantage over another by breaking the law, you have thrown a major wrench into the middle of the justice system. Because that is not fairness. That is not just. The second reason why we believe this would constitute a revision of the Constitution is that it provides for no alternative remedy to exclusion of the evidence. H.R. 91 specifically says that it would not create a cause of action. Whether it would eliminate any cause of action is a whole other question, but currently there is no well-recognized cause of action for violation of Article 1, Section 9. Unlike the federal government, which has a Federal Civil Rights Act that allows citizens to sue the government when their federal constitutional rights are violated, Oregon has no such statute. And although the ACLU and others have argued from time to time that there is an implied cause of action under Article 1, Section 9, that, as far as I know, that has not specifically been recognized by the Oregon court. But if this legislature were to pass an amendment to the Constitution that eliminated the only remedy that currently exists in a criminal case when the government breaks the law, exclusion of that illegally obtained evidence, without providing some other remedy, we think that that would be a major change to the Constitution that would be considered a revision. And again, we think it's a bad idea. We don't see any way to do it that is not going to have the same kinds of constitutional problems. Regarding HJR, a couple of final points on HJR 91. I think what in large part gave rise to the desire to lock in Article 1, Section 9, the Search and Seizure Clause, with the Federal Fourth Amendment was concern with decisions of the Oregon Supreme Court that prosecutors and law enforcement folks and victims' rights advocates believe were wrong. And they want to overturn those decisions. I understand their rationale. I understand their feeling that way. But this legislature passed two bills last session that I believe will have the effect of overturning the decisions in more than a dozen, if not scores, of Oregon Supreme Court search and seizure decisions over the last 15 years. And I've distributed to you copies of those two statutes that are relevant. The first is House Bill 2433. That is the statute you passed last session that significantly expands the authority of police officers to both make inquiries during a pedestrian stop and during a traffic stop, and which gives law enforcement the authority to request consent to search, even when they don't have reasonable suspicion that there is illegal activity in a vehicle. The prior statute, which greatly limited what we have termed in the past as fishing expeditions during traffic stops, is now gone from the statutes. Police officers specifically have that authority. Those cases where evidence was excluded because officers went beyond their authority under the statute, we believe are now a dead letter. Because they have that authority under statute, that's why the ACLU opposed House Bill 2433 so strongly 2 years ago. We lost that battle. It's now law. And I really think that until we see how some of these issues play out over the next 5 years or so, it's much too soon to be talking about repealing Article 1, Section 9. The other statute was part of Senate Bill 936, the bill that was designed to implement Measure 40, and is codified at RS 136.432, which specifically prohibits any court in Oregon from excluding relevant and otherwise admissible evidence merely because it was obtained in violation of a statute. Unless that action also violated the Oregon Constitution or the United States Constitution. So to the extent that the Oregon Supreme Court has a whole series of cases, and they did, excluding evidence based on violations of statute, those cases are history. They may be re-argued, and defense attorneys will argue that those same actions violated the Oregon Constitution. But again, the reason we so strenuously opposed the passage of this provision was that we believed that it would effectively overturn those earlier decisions of the Oregon Supreme Court. So we think the need for HJR 91 is, even among, on the part of the proponents, who want to overturn every decision of the Oregon Supreme Court and make the Oregon Supreme Court irrelevant is unnecessary and very unwise at this stage of our criminal law in Oregon. Mr. Chair, I have covered the remaining resolutions in my written testimony. I don't think I need to go into them now, except to mention that H.R. 93 is also in its current form very broad in its application and would also, we believe, violate the state constitutional provision against revising the Constitution, and we believe would also violate the federal Constitution for the same reasons I outlined on H.R. 91. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair. Again, I appreciate having the opportunity. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Lincoln? Mr. CLU? Thank you, David.
Thank you
for your patience.
Mr. Chair, I will say one thing. The other day, David said 10 or 15 minutes. I just wanted to know what time it is.
You
start
about
1:15.
More
than the time.
That's
okay.
We'll
watch him next time.
He had to wait the longest.
That's true.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. Close to public hearing on House Joint Resolution. Let me get this right. What do you say? 87 through 94. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3492. Mark Gardner. Here's Mark.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3492. House Bill 3492 deals with a problem that's known as gray marketing, and I'd like to take just a moment to describe that to you. What happens is a cigarette manufacturer like Philip Morris will manufacture Marlboro cigarettes. They manufacture those cigarettes both for the domestic market and also for the international market. There are different blends, different additives in some cases, and differences between the export cigarettes and the domestic cigarettes. Those that are domestically produced are circulated in the United States for consumption. Those that are for export are exported out of the country. What happens is that once they leave the country, sometimes they end up coming back, and there'll be a distributor in some place like the Bahamas or some other place or port who will then get the shipment, buy it, turn around, and send it back to a port in the United States where it will re-enter the country. The reason they'll do that is because the cost of the export cigarettes is generally about half of what it is for the domestic cigarettes. A carton of Marlboro's wholesales for about $18 a carton for domestic market and only about $9 per carton for the export market. And when it comes back into the country, it is then basically through a distributor put into the domestic market, and there are markups taken by the various distributors as it goes through commerce to the states. Now, why should we be concerned about this? There are basically two reasons, the first of which is that there are basically differences between the cigarettes. There are different blends. In the case, at least, of the RJR Reynolds cigarettes, there are additives in the export cigarettes but not in the domestic cigarettes, and consumers basically are not getting what they have bargained for when, in fact, they buy the cigarettes that they think are domestically produced as opposed to the export cigarettes. These cigarettes are marked for export only when they leave the country. However, when they come back, often that marking is masked over or removed, or they're repackaged. Sometimes they don't contain the warnings that the Surgeon General and the federal government requires, because in the international market, those warnings aren't required by law, whereas they are required for cigarettes that are sold in the United States. They'll then come back to a place like Oregon. The tax stamps will be purchased. They will be marketed and basically go into commerce. beyond the consumer protection aspect of this, which is important, there's also the aspect in terms of the Master Settlement Agreement and monies coming to the state of Oregon. Under the Master Settlement Agreement, there's what is known as the volume adjustment. And the volume adjustment basically works this way. There is a fraction that is determined. The denominator is the amount of domestic sales in 1997. The numerator is the domestic sales in the year before the payment is made. To the extent that export cigarettes are consumed in Oregon, that reduces the number of domestic cigarettes that are purchased, because for each one of those export cigarettes, it's displacing a domestic cigarette that could be purchased. And in fact, what happens is that reduces the amount of money that Oregon would receive under the settlement. And so for those two basic reasons, we're very interested in stopping this practice. That is, brings us to House Bill 3492, and very quickly I'll go through the bill. The operative section in the bill is really Section 3. And what it does is it provides that if someone sells or puts a tax stamp on a pack of cigarettes or a carton of cigarettes that is for export only, and it's in violation of either federal law regarding the labeling requirements or the language for export only appears on that carton or those packages of cigarettes, or if they were exported into the country in violation of 26 U.S.C. 5754, or if the package has been altered to mask it over, they basically commit a misdemeanor. And we think that that will have the effect of basically stopping this type of gray marketing. We also give the Department of Justice the ability to bring an Unlawful Trade Practices Act action against the distributor or retailer. And we allow the Department of State Police or some other law enforcement agency, when we found that there are cigarettes that are being marketed this way, to be able to go out and seize the cigarettes and either sell them for export out of the country or to destroy them, as the case may be. The rest of the bill has mostly to do with some cleanup language for the non-participating manufacturer section to allow the Department of Revenue to be able to give information out to the Department of Justice and others to make sure that the people who are not signed up on the Master Settlement Agreement are complying with their obligations to make escrow payments. And I think it's a good bill and it should pass. I also have a couple of affidavits that support the information I gave the committee a moment ago about the fact that there are differences in the blends and in the additives as far as the cigarettes are concerned. These are affidavits by cigarette company executives that were entered in litigation in Colorado. And I'd like to make that part of the record. I'd be glad to answer your question.
Mark, on subsection 4, line 33, page 2. It says, destroy or sell back for destruction or export only. Who's going to be selling it back? Not law enforcement. Who would do that?
That would be the Department of Revenue in conjunction with the state police or other law enforcement agency. What it does, it gives Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, it gives the Department of Revenue and the other law enforcement agency the option either to destroy the cigarettes, which they could do, or they could sell those cigarettes back to one of the cigarette companies for export out of the United States as the cigarettes were supposed to be done in the first place.
Okay. Does that usually denote a large quantity if you're going to sell it back to them?
Oh, absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, absolutely. I mean, if somebody sees a carton, that probably wouldn't occur. On the other hand, if it was a truckload of cigarettes, we might be talking about a different thing.
Thank you. Further questions for Judge Gardner? Any Duncan?
No, I think not.
Mr. Chairman, one last additional comment, 10 seconds. There are some amendments to this that are being prepared to protect the retailers and distributors who have been kind enough to be generally supportive of the bill to make sure they get proper notices as to the bill taking effect and also prior notice of any potential seizures that may occur before those seizures could in fact occur, and we hope to have those amendments, and we would not want the bill to pass or move without them.
The bill is rescheduled for Tuesday morning at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay.
Be sure to get yourself out of your trundle bed. Stand up.
Mr. Chair, a question, Mark. Maybe 7:10. If you are a retailer, would you have knowledge of this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, there's a requirement that the Department of Revenue send notice out to the retailers to make them aware of this legislation so that they hopefully will not purchase these types of cigarettes.
My question, Mr. Chair, is do they can tell the difference when they're purchasing them? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, generally that's because of the price and who is selling the cigarettes.
That was a clue, okay. But the marking, you said, in some cases, are those marked out in a bigger package before that gets to the retailer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, sometimes that marking is covered over, but if someone is coming in to sell the cigarettes that's not the normal distributor and they're selling them for dramatically lower prices,
that's the clue, right?
That's the clue. It's kind of like buying stolen property.
I've never bought stolen property.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Close the public hearing on 34.2, and because he is here, the great one, we'll open a public hearing for his testimony. I'm going to go quickly to two other bills, not the back of his bill. House Bill 3388, that's right, for Representative Ryan Decker. Step forward, Representative Ryan Decker. I want the members of the committee to know that because you were good enough to come today, I ordered cookies for you, Senator Duncan, and you, Senator Toronto. They're in the bag. They're not for anybody in the audience. Somebody else is going to kick the cookies, let them know. They're just for you two and me. It's just we were willing to do this.
And he ordered them, but I have
to. Staff, yeah. So.
Mr. Chair, do I constitute the audience?
You what?
Am I a member of the audience?
No, yes.
For that
you
purpose?
Do not get the cookies. You get no cookies. These cookies are for those that I care about.
Which bill was that you were talking
about this time? I understand. All right. Representative Ryan Decker, you're here for House Bill 3388, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
So, tell us, I assume you like the bill, right?
Mr. Chair, distinguished members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think this is a very fine bill. It comes to you from the House with 50 aye votes, one nay vote. It has two primary purposes, and it deals with sweepstakes promotions and protecting generally senior citizens against some egregious practices that have occurred in across the nation, and certainly in Oregon, in terms of sweepstakes practices. The bill essentially does two things. One would be it allows for a disclaimer on the promotion so that an individual receiving the sweepstakes knows of their odds at winning in the sweepstakes, and it does one other thing, and this just provides recourse for someone who has been taken advantage of by sweepstakes through the Department of Justice. Keith Shepard, who will probably come testify at some point on this bill from the DOJ, helped draft the amendments, which just provide recourse if someone has spent over $500 in the previous year on the sweepstakes or would like their name to be removed from the list because they have not had such a positive experience being solicited by these sweepstakes.
The disclaimer would also have to be in 12.
That is correct, Senator Duncan.
Yes, we're talking about older people, and I can identify with that. You can be able to see it.
Next, 12-point print. Well, I wouldn't.
Both.
You know,
both.
I don't want to argue with you, but isn't AA, is the American Federalist Act, 14 to 16, what's that, Representative Becker? Do you know what the requirement is in that act? No, right?
I do not know, Senator.
You might want to look at that, because probably it wouldn't hurt to go if it's higher. You wouldn't be opposed to going higher, would you, in terms of the second amendment of the bill?
I would not. That conforms with the spirit of the bill, which is just a disclaimer that is visible so that the person that is receiving the disclaimer knows that they have not, in fact, won $500,000 or $1 million, and that there is some visible disclaimer. And we felt on the House side that a 12-point bold would achieve that.
Okay.
With me briefly is Mr. Philip, or Dr. Philip Levesque from the Association of Retired Citizens.
Okay, I will take his testimony. Wait, any questions or concerns or things you want to ask Representative Deckard? Okay, Dr. Laveau, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Philip Levesque from Malala. I'm a state officer in AARP, and John Glassbach, who was the former chairman of the SLC, asked me to present the AARP position. This is the position of old geezers, and I note that one person on the committee has already testified that he might be among that group.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment? I have reminded the Honorable Representative Becker to the occasion people have referred to as looking young, that at one point I was a legislator his age. He too will look like this someday.
Mr. Chair, I do not agree with that previous statement by my
Mr. Chairman and Senator Duncan, if I have insulted you in any way, I apologize.
No, you haven't insulted.
One thing I do note is that my children, who are in the 40 years old or so, do not get any of these kind of things. This was brought very sharply to me. My wife was brought up in England, and she has made catalog purchases on several occasions. And the first day that one of these things came to our in our mail, you have won $1 million. My wife was absolutely ecstatic and in such a state that I did not have the courage to try to correct her at all. A few weeks later, she got a notice that we're sorry that we made a mistake and you didn't win. And I caught hell because why didn't you tell me? So what we've got to do, what I hope we can do, is get rid of this trash mail. One of the things that's going on here is that those of us who do pay for mail are subsidizing this garbage. Now, another thing that's come up very recently, one of the Oregon banks, I heard over television, sold their client list of 900,000 names to some outfit in Massachusetts for $4 million. Now, they got caught at this, but this should not have happened. Now, in addition to this, my daughter-in-law used to work in a place where these papers came in Des Moines, Iowa. And any time that one of these things came through but did not have an order for a magazine, she was told to throw it in the trash. So this is unfair from the start. Now, finally, I will say, you individuals have the authority to do this, and I hope that you take the responsibility. And Representative Deckard, I think, has already stated the position of the House of Representatives, so I hope you will follow through.
Thank you. Comments? Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hecker.
Submitted in addition is the -A4 amendments, which were from the DOJ, which just clarify that this is for mail sweepstakes and not for a retail or an in-store sweepstakes promotion, which we're trying to get at is mail sweepstakes.
Thank you for your consideration. Thank you very much. What I want to do, I know there's about four other people signed up, but what I want to do, psychological reasons, I have two other bills, only one person signed up. I want to get them out of the way, and then we'll come back. So, I'm not just going to start by four. I close the public hearing for the time being on House Bill 3388, and open the public hearing on House Bill 2985, and what? Yeah. There's only one person. It makes the record messy?
It really does.
All right. That's what I like to do, but I guess... All right. Open the public hearing on 2985. Well, to make sure the record doesn't get messy. There's cookies over there, guys.
They're gone.
I already ate one.
You let Duncan get
David Slater. OTLA, Multnomah. Against it. don't know who's for it, but all right. 2985.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Slater. I'm an attorney in Portland. I specialize in representing crime victims, especially children. This bill, House Bill 2985, is apparently in response to two unanimous decisions of the Oregon Supreme Court, Fearing v. Bucher and Warren v. Swenson. I was chaired as a friend of the court in those cases, and that's my familiarity with this area of the law, specifically these cases and my interest in this bill. I want to make three points here today, if I can. First, that the Warren and Fearing cases are the application of longstanding law, not only in Oregon, but across the United States. There's nothing radical, revolutionary. There's not even a change in them from longstanding Oregon law. Second, the bill you have before you is unworkable. It's unworkable because it speaks in terms of an exception for intentional torts, and there is no clearly defined category of intentional tort known to the law. Third, the law of unintended consequences is the only law that is really, we can guarantee, is going to be the result of this bill if it passes, because the circumstances that I believe most people would assume an employer would be liable for might be prohibited under some interpretations of this bill, and we can't say whether they would or not because we don't know what intentional tort is in this bill. Let me start with the concept that the case law, as it stands after the Warren and Fearing decisions, is sound law. In those cases, the Supreme Court unanimously held that there are conceivable circumstances under which the sexual molestation of a child by an employee can have been caused by the scope of the employee's duties, acts within the scope of the employee's duties, and therefore that it's conceivable under those circumstances that the employer would be liable for the acts of the employee under the doctrine of respondeat superior. There's nothing radical in that decision. There's nothing even novel about it. It simply applies case law that has been on the books in Oregon since 1988 in the case of Chesterman versus Barman. And the rule of Chesterman and the rule of Warren and the rule of Fearing is simply this, that the law asks the following question. Did the acts that were authorized by the employer or that were done to serve the interests of the employer cause the injury to the victim? Liability follows causation. That's Oregon law of respondeat superior. If the operations of the business cause the injury, generally the employer will be liable even if there was some intent or bad motive on the part of the employee. None of those cases, not Warren, not Fearing, not Chesterman, answered the question whether in a particular case there is liability, because none of those cases went up on after trial. The court only said that it's a question of causation and that it's a question for the jury and we're going to let them decide. Now, what this bill does is say that there can be no respondeat superior liability. By that I mean there can be no liability of an employer for the acts of an employee if the employee was committing an intentional tort. Okay? We have ideas as lawyers of a category we call intentional torts, but it's just shorthand. It's not a term of art that has a definition. And because of that, we're using a term here that simply cannot be applied. And I spent this morning, Chair, members of the committee, going through my trusty green volumes of the Oregon State Bar Tort COE and going through what are generally categorized as intentional torts to see if intent is required. And what I found that in the vast majority of cases, an intent to injure is not required for what we call intentional torts. For example, the sort of prototype intentional tort is battery. You punch someone in the nose. A sexual assault is a battery. But a battery is also any non-consensual, volitional touching of another that either causes injury or is offensive. If a doctor
operates on a patient without consent. It's a battery. If your dentist puts you under and is going to remove your third molar from the back and sees two other teeth and decides, oh, those don't look so good either, I'm going to take them out, it's a battery. There was no consent. Even though there was no intent to injure. Now, you might say, fine, I'm glad you did it, because I didn't want to go through this process again. But if we're looking at the definition of a tort, that's a battery. Is that an intentional tort as meant by the language of this statute? I don't know. And no one knows.
Mr. Dardo.
You mentioned intent. Can't the intent be implied?
In most cases, Senator Tarnow, members of the committee, the chair, the common law of torts does not use the concept of implied intent in the tort concept, in the tort context. I'm sure there are instances where it comes up, and I can't think of any right now.
Mr. Chair, I wonder, Senator Tarnow, what were you thinking was implied?
Implied by your actions, that you intend to do that which you do, is implied. I think that's what I mean by implied.
Chairman Santano, the way that torts are generally defined, that issue doesn't come up. So that the, for example, the tort of conversion, taking someone. If I think this microphone is mine. Looks like the one I left here yesterday. And I put it in my pocket and cut the cord and take it home with me. I don't have to intend to be stealing it for it to be the tort of conversion. I have to have a volitional act. I mean, if it's simply an accident, it's not the tort of conversion. But if I volitionally take this, thinking it's mine, and I'm wrong, it's the tort of conversion. Is that an intentional tort under this statute?
I don't know.
We don't know because it's not a term that has a well-recognized meaning. I went through a long list of torts, conversion, nuisance, fraud and misrepresentation, malicious prosecution. Doesn't require malice, doesn't require intent, just requires the prosecution, an effort to prosecute someone either civilly or criminally without probable cause. Is it an intentional tort? I don't know. Is false arrest an intentional tort? I can't tell. Civil rights violations. Sometimes that can be intentional, sometimes not. Generally, deliberate indifference is enough for a civil rights tort. Assault and battery, I've touched on. Intentional infliction of emotional distress. In Oregon, that tort can be accomplished by a volitional act without an intent to cause injury. Is that an intentional tort? I don't know. The only tort I could find that requires an intent to cause injury is interference with contracts. Of all the torts that we categorize roughly in shorthand as intentional torts, the only one that requires an intent to cause injury that I find is interference with contract or business relationships, because generally those are otherwise privileged acts. Defamation. Defamation may or may not be an intentional tort. Even defamation of a public figure. Reckless indifference is enough to form the basis of the tort. However, we categorize it as an intentional tort. Is that what's meant by the statute? I don't know. Now, you could, one I suppose could approach this and say what we mean, and we can change the language, is we're talking about volitional acts. We're talking about voluntary activity by the person who's causing the tort, the employee. But if that's the case, senators, we're going into the category of negligence because most negligent acts, most negligent injuries arise from some volitional act. If I'm speeding down the street because I'm late to this hearing and I cause an accident, it's a volitional act. But it's called negligence. We categorize it that way. If a person is driving drunk, it's still called negligence, but it's a volitional act if that causes an injury. This bill doesn't take a scalpel to the problem, or even a hatchet. I think it takes an egg beater to it. It just throws the law of torts into the air because it uses a term that doesn't really have a meaning except as a shorthand category of that has no specific definition either. But we have to have shorthand for keeping track of things. So the only law that I think we can be sure of coming about from this bill is the law of unintended consequences. However this bill is interpreted, it will cause a radical change in Oregon law. I wanted to comment on the state of the law first, because this is, I'm sure, those of you that practice law recognize Prosser and Torrance. This I got when I was in law school. It's the 1964 edition. When I was in law school, I was a young man, so it was some time ago.
Counsel, I think I must inform you that because I'm a magistrate, that doesn't mean they're in law school. Both Senator Duncan and Senator Tarno have been to law school, so I'll just say you're no learning my counsel.
I didn't.
They've never had to go through that ordeal, so I just think you should afford it.
Thank you, Senator.
We're learning now.
Reading this book of evidence is terrible things to me. Just with my colleagues, you know, they put me in therapy and I've never recovered. Just
I hope that the witness will be very careful and
he's on tender ground with you then. Yes, go ahead,
Thompson. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this law of torts by William Prosser was the standard legal text of torts then, and I think it still is in later editions.
Mm-hmm.
My point of reading this paragraph is that the rule that an employer can be liable for an intentional act by an employee is not new law. Prosser writes in 1964, it has been recognized that even intentional torts may be so reasonably connected with the employment as to be within the scope of duty, and the present tendency is to extend the employer's responsibility for such conduct. It may be said in general that the master is held liable for any intentional tort committed by the servant where its purpose, however misguided, is wholly or in part to further the master's business. And then he gives some examples. Thus, he will be held liable where a bus driver plows a competitor's bus into the ditch. Well, under this bill, perhaps he wouldn't be liable, depending on what intentional tort means. He goes on to other examples. Where a bus driver assaults a trespasser to eject him from the bus, or a salesman makes false statements about the products he is selling. That's the tort, usually called the intentional tort, of product defamation, economic defamation. Is that prohibited now? Is the employer responsible? We don't know. Or defames a competitor, or disparages his product, or where the servant resorts to false imprisonment or malicious prosecution. And then it goes on and gives many more examples, and I'm sure the more recent editions have even more. Where this bill, interpreted broadly, and I don't know how a court couldn't interpret it broadly or narrowly since the term is so inherently ambiguous, could, and conceivably very likely would, prohibit employer liability in all those circumstances that the common law has recognized for the last 50 or 100 years. Let me give you some quick examples if I can. A tavern owner tells his bouncer to remove a patron. The tavern owner uses excessive force, causes serious injury. Should the tavern owner be liable? Well, under common law today, yes, he would be liable. Under this bill, perhaps not. A customer goes to his or her bank and says, the bank's motto might be, trust us with your money. It takes a deposit and gives the teller $1,000, and the teller says, thank you, here's your receipt, puts $1,000 in their pocket, or his pocket. Under the common law today, the bank would be liable because taking the money was within the scope of duty. But we have an intervening intentional tort, the tort of conversion. It's from the law, just be theft. Under the common law today, the bank is liable. I think every reasonable person on the street would expect the bank to be liable. But under this bill, maybe not, because we have a so-called intentional tort intervening, the tort of conversion. Other examples, a salesman for a used car dealer rolls back the odometer and misrepresents the mileage on the car, or misrepresents that it was in an accident, or a flood, or some way damaged or rebuilt. Under today's law, the used car dealer would be responsible. Under this bill, probably not. because the intentional tort of fraud and misrepresentation has occurred. I can go on, especially with consumer protection examples forever. You can think of stockbrokers. You can think of insurance salespeople. I believe we're listening to a representative here from ARC. All of the elderly people that are taken advantage by annuity salesmen who defraud them. Should the employer get off the hook? The employer that gave that salesman the power to go out there, the ID card, the advertising to support him, should they get off the hook just because that salesman committed a fraud? I don't think most people would think so. But under this bill, it's likely that they would. One other example, and then I'm done. A neighbor is logging his property. The foreman of the property owner, of the property owner that's doing the logging, is on commission. He's going to get half of whatever he logs. He sees some choice trees on your property. He crosses over and logs them. It's the intentional tort of trespass. He shares the money with the property owner, his boss. Should the property owner get off the hook because the intentional tort of trespass intervened and it wasn't authorized? He's walking around with your money in his pocket. He shouldn't get off the hook. And I believe that this bill simply tries to do more than can be done with the term intentional tort, and will create a raft of unintended consequences. The common law has had more than 150 years to evolve the concept of respondeat superior and employer liability. It's done so in conjunction with the complex evolution of tort law. It moves by inches sometimes, it moves by small steps, it almost never moves by big steps. When it makes a mistake, it has the power to correct them. I think to go at a principle of law of this long standing with a bill that is not clearly thought out can cause a great deal of harm to a great many people. The common law is a lot like capitalism. It's not perfect, but it tends to fix itself. And interference of a bill like this kind can turn that process on its head. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Council Slater?
Thank you very much.
Testimony. Thank you. I'm going to Max Williams, please. Chip Lazenby, you're going to testify too, Chip? Okay. Representative Williams will go first. And then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate you hearing this bill. This bill was a bill that was, in fact, in response to two Supreme Court cases recently. And I just briefly want to tell you what our intent was in the House Civil Judiciary Committee with respect to this bill. The effort was to draft a bill which essentially returned us to the state of the law pre those two Supreme Court cases. The belief was, and I think in my mind still is, what those cases did was open essentially a new doorway with respect to the issue of vicarious liability within the law. And it blurred the line with respect to the concept of course and scope of employment. Representative Shetterly and I and the members of that committee spent a fair amount of time taking testimony on these issues and hearing from people on both sides. I am still of a belief, and I won't say that what we've done necessarily is perfect. I've heard statements made by representatives of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association that they believe that that what we did do goes much further than what I am suggesting we are attempting to accomplish. I believe the governor's representative will perhaps testify to the same thing. It certainly was not our intent to go further than that, and if there's a way we can come to some mutual accommodation on the language of the bill to try to reach that objective, then I'm certainly willing to come along and would certainly recommend to the chairman of the Civil Judiciary Committee on the House side that if we can make those amendments and they're appropriate, that he would move for concurrence when the bill came back across from the Senate. But the point that I wanted to make, and I would also comment just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I received a copy of a letter directed towards Senator Bryant today
from my good friend and also fellow lawyer Kelly Clark, who argued these two cases. Kelly's known to many of you, I think, and also a personal friend of mine. Kelly was unavailable to testify in front of the committee today because of a long-scheduled deposition in another case. And in that letter, he had asked Senator Bryan for an opportunity to come down sometime next week and testify. And I would certainly, on his behalf, make that request. I believe, as the person who took these two cases to the Supreme Court, he ought to have the opportunity to address the committee, and you ought to probably address some questions to him about that. But what I would like to say is that I do think that the Oregon Supreme Court took a step with the two cases it decided earlier this year that takes us to a different level with respect to vicarious liability. And what the intention of House Bill 2985, as we amended it in the Civil Judiciary Committee, was to essentially return us back to the status quo. It is coming up in other areas. I know that some of the argument is that this issue is merely in these two cases that involve horrible circumstances involving the misuse of a trust relationship with respect to sexual abuse of children, and those are very, very emotional circumstances. But I can assure you that within the employment law community, these cases are being raised outside of just that context. And that was the concern that Representative Cheverly and I had. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any further questions. I may actually ask to come back when you address this issue again with Representative Cheverly and engage in a more thorough discussion of the issue.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Representative Max Williams, I'm just curious, you didn't get a chance to hear our previous witness testimony on the tort law and the sort of, I'm just wondering if there's a chance that you might be able to get a chance to at least review his testimony.
Most certainly. I'm familiar with Mr. Slater and have great respect for him as a lawyer, and I'd be pleased to review his testimony and work with he and the representatives of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
I'm not a lawyer on this, but it's kind of a compelling kind of a presentation for me.
Councilor Lassinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Lassinger. I'm legal counsel to Governor John Kitzhaber. I've submitted some written testimony, and I will make my remarks brief. I agree that this is a reaction to two cases that were before the Oregon Supreme Court, Fearing versus Bucher and Lurham versus Swenson. These cases both did involve child sex abuse, and there are some very appealing employers involved in this, say church and the Boy Scouts. However, I think this bill goes a bit too far for several reasons. One, it extends an immunity from liability to all employers under a vicarious liability standpoint, and I think that it would be impossible to make that judgment in all cases under all facts. If you go back and look at the Lurham and the Fearing cases, what had occurred in that was that the trial court had dismissed those employers. The Supreme Court merely said that there were interests that were involved where a jury may find that there was some liability and that they should not be dismissed at the front end of the case. I think that shows you how the facts can vary in a number of different ways, and that perhaps a jury should be better positioned to make that judgment about liability rather than the legislature and a judge up front under all circumstances saying a jury never gets to consider liability. There are possibly some other alternatives that can address some of the concerns. Representative Williams and I have discussed those, but the bill in its current form is not one that I would recommend that the governor sign. My written testimony is a part of the record and for the committee to consider.
Thank you. Questions for Council Lever?
Mr. Chair, just a brief question for Max. Am I wrong, or is this an anti-fishing expedition for deep pockets?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarno, I won't go that far, but I will say that one of the issues that is presented, I think, by the two decisions that were made is it creates a situation where if you are, and let's use, for example, a daycare provider who could be in a similar situation to the church or the Boy Scouts here where they're entrusted with a special relationship for children. You could be a daycare provider under the current law, as it's been determined by these cases. You could have done everything right. You could have done the background check on the employees. You could institute appropriate policies. You could adopt all the appropriate policy manuals. You could give the appropriate employee training. You could do everything right and not be negligent under the current circumstances. And yet, if one of your employees, who you've done all the proper screening on, had acted out and potentially abused a child, there is a question now as to whether or not that abuse could be technically within the course and scope of employment, as it's been determined by these cases, or at least that's an issue that a jury will get to decide. And prior to these cases, an action, if you've done everything right, you would be able to essentially file a motion for summary judgment and regularly get them granted. In fact, that's what had happened in the two cases that Mr. Clark had taken up to the Supreme Court. So what it means is that there's going to be some practical applications of this. It's going to mean an increase in insurance costs or maybe even a loss of availability of coverage. Because these are emotional issues, they rarely get to a jury. Because the parties involved in them don't want to run the risk of the possibility of harsh judgment that would result therefrom. And so there's a policy issue. And as I discussed this again with my good friend, Kelly Clark, and we debated this issue, his point, and it's not an unreasonable point, is, but there's a cost here. There's a cost, and who better to bear the cost? Whether they're at fault or not, whether the Boy Scouts did something wrong or not, or the Catholic Church did something wrong or not, who's better to bear the cost in this situation, the victim or the institution? Because the individual, the perpetrator, rarely has any assets to deal with the emotional damage that's resulted from this and the pain and suffering. So that's the policy question. Who better to bear the cost, the institution or the victim, is the way that Mr. Clark would phrase that question. It's an important question to answer, but I would suggest to you that when you look, and I'll use a daycare provider, I'll use the Boy Scouts, I'll use the Catholic Church, in all the good things that those programs provide, and there are going to be a couple of bad eggs in every basket, no matter how careful you are, we run the risk by moving forward in this direction of essentially crippling those programs or crippling the ability of daycare providers to get the insurance they need to provide that service. So there is a question, a policy question, that frankly needs to be addressed on this issue. And I'll tell you, I served nationally with the Boy Scouts of America on several committees, and I've worked with the local Boy Scout Council in my area for many, many years. And I have never once defended them, I don't mean legally defended them, but publicly defended them, when they have been at fault for failing to follow one of their own policies or procedures in doing the kind of screening and background checks that are necessary. But what this does, frankly, in my opinion, is it opens them up to a situation where they can be potentially on the hook even when they've done everything right. And that creates a problem.
How long has it been like, Mr. Tarno? I think I heard a portion of Mr. Slater's testimony before, and he was talking about different types of situations where employees commit different types of intentional torts. I think that under those circumstances, there are different types of training and preventative actions that an employer can take. I don't think that somebody who's running a car dealership is worried about people turning the odometer's back and committing an intentional fraud. Needs to go through type of training that will screen them out for child abuse, but I think the Boy Scouts certainly would need to do that, and some of these other institutions. So perhaps rather than a blanket exemption from liability, this committee or the legislature might consider the development of some sound affirmative defenses that an employer could assert and say, well, I have followed these principles and done these things, and therefore I'm entitled to not be subject to vicarious liability. Now, I only have the germ of the idea. I don't have any details in mind. Representative Williams and I discussed this on the way down, but I think that's another policy option out there, because on the other side, Senator Tarno, of anti-deep pocket fishing is the fact is the deterrent value that the law provides, so that we don't have the child abuse and we don't have the intentional torts and frauds that can occur.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit concerned, gentlemen, because the failure to train, the failure to supervise, not only is them within the public sector as opposed to private. And my concern goes to the fact that you've got a small employer out there who is totally naive to these issues about failure to train, failure to supervise, or to discipline an employee, and the guidelines that go along with that is just plain old-fashioned naivety on his part. And I just like
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carno, I guess this may be an issue that Mr. Lazenby and I and others may not be in complete agreement on, but it was as to what the effect of the current language of the law does. It has not been my intent, nor was it the intent of Representative Shetterly, to do anything with respect to limiting the ability to sue an institution for failing for any kind of negligence. In other words, it was not our intent to protect any institution or employer who has been negligent in their hiring or in their training or in their screening or in their background checks. That's not what we were trying to accomplish with this. What we were trying to accomplish was to put back to the point we thought we were before those two Supreme Court cases on strictly the issue of when an action is outside the course and scope of employment, and that's where we were headed. And if we haven't achieved that, and if I'm convinced in my discussions with Representative Lazenby,
Chip couldn't afford the pay cut. That's right.
if Council Lazenby and Mr. Slater and others can convince me that in fact we have gone too far with the language, I'm happy to try to clarify that. Because that's not the intent.
Well, it would be nice if you two could go outside the hall with Council Slater and in 5 minutes or so resolve your differences. I'm not sure that can be done. It may be one of these policy questions you just got to go up and down on, but in view of what you said that your intent is, and we got this letter from the governor, and I think what the letter is saying, I could be wrong, but I think what it's saying, I'm slow.
I've heard that.
That there's a little word that's not in here that's in here, and so that's what I think is going on. And that's all I'm saying. But that's up to you. Say maybe this is something. It's got to be up or down. That's the way it is. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the sentiment. I think for a couple of reasons, it would behoove us to talk further. And I think there's other members of your committee who probably ought to and would want to weigh in on this. And I'm willing to work it further. I believe Representative Shetterly is willing to work it further. And it may still in the end be the policy choice as maybe I laid it out. But I do believe, and I think it makes sense on an issue of this magnitude that we continue to talk about it and do the best we can to make it as narrow as possible. So when we do make the policy decision, we know exactly where it is we're deciding.
Okay. Well, I'm not saying I probably couldn't get it. I know they're making it for the committee. I know your relationship is here. I'm just saying that there's just this little thing here, a little bit of a spot here, that's all. So I don't know. I think there can be done more about that. So further questions for these two high learned councils? Senator Duncan, anything for any of you?
Okay, thank you very much for coming down to testify. I appreciate that.
And with that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2985. I'm going to go back because we're waiting. I just tried something that didn't work very well. I got misled by a little sign up sheet. I want to go back. What?
Yep.
House Bill 3388. Open public hearing on Richard Boyle and Pete Shepherd. They're going to be followed by Mike Dewey and John Powell. So Mr. Boyle and Mr. Shepherd. Where's Mr. Boyle? You couldn't have left. He's already left. And then Mr. Shepherd, you'll be up, and then I want both Mr. Dewey and Mr. Powell up here at the same time. I just leave them together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here in support of House Bill 3388, and in particular in support of the A-engrossed version, hand-engrossed with the DOJ, by DOJ, with the A4 amendments, which you should, your staff is distributing to you at this point. You've already heard the background from Representative Deckert. Very briefly, the bill does concern Oregonians who are vulnerable to direct mail campaigns that pitch deceptive sweepstakes promotions or phony contests. And typically, these victims are older Oregonians who are walking the line between being fully competent in their own affairs on the one hand and trusting vulnerability on the other. We have instances in which these victims have spent as much as $60,000 or $70,000 on useless trinkets and multiple and duplicative magazine subscriptions. Between January 1st, 1998 and the end of that year, the Oregon Department of Justice received 168 complaints from 168 different Oregonians complaining about abusive or deceptive sweepstakes marketing programs. The department is participating in 13 multi-state enforcement actions and is in leadership in five of those leadership positions in five of those 13 multi-state investigations. I understand I'm seeing today for the first time some suggested amendments by the Direct Marketing Association, some of which are not a problem from the department standpoint at least, and I'm happy to sit down and visit with the representatives of that association to see if there's anything further that we can do to deal with their concerns, though some of them that they have suggested would not be acceptable to the department. With the Dash 4 amendments, we think this bill is ready to go, and if there are some additional amendments that we can work out with the Direct Marketing Association rather promptly, we're not worried about including those as well for the committee's consideration, but we think this bill is ready to go, and we urge the committee to support it.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Shepard? Well, you got off easy. You like Pete, huh? Is that what you like, as opposed to Peter? Is that the way it is?
Mr. Chair, in this forum, I'll go by anything.
What's that?
In this forum, I'll respond to anything you like.
No, I'm just curious. You like Pete is what you demand people call you. Is that right?
My preference.
That's your preference. Oh, yeah. Well, that's nice.
I don't blame
you. You know, I don't care. My name's Peter, and they can call me whatever. I don't care. So I just want to mean something to you to be called Pete.
We call you all kinds of things.
Yeah, I know, but I want to know, since you've got my name, why he wants to be called Pete versus Peter.
Mr. Chair, did he know it means the rock?
Yeah, did you know it means the rock?
I'm aware of that.
Pete is not rock. Peter is a rock.
Yeah, all I can say is that's what I've always been known.
So. Okay, well, that's okay, Peter. I just thought I'd ask you. I've always wondered because I've seen you here before and I wondered why you chose Pete versus Peter. That's okay. All right. Mr. Drury, Mr. Powell. I want you to gather up here because both these gentlemen live in my area and they don't like me. I still want them up here together. And Mike Dewey's against this thing. Mr. Powell's not as usual, mysterious, doesn't tell us, so we'll find out. We'll start with you, Mr. Dewey. You don't like Bill, so why don't you tell us? You have the amendments now, all that, right? You know all about the amendments and everything? Because I don't know whether that needs to be part of this discussion. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey or Michael Dewey, depending on the situation. We represent the Direct Marketing Association, and we come to the debate a little bit late, and we apologize for that. And we have suggested some amendments to the Attorney General, Peter Shepard, depending on your preference. And obviously, we need to sit down a little bit further and talk about those and also with the sponsor. But let me take just a minute and explain our concerns. The Direct Marketing Association is an association of businesses that do telemarketing, mail marketing, that are maligned from time to time. But quite frankly, there are an awful lot of people that enjoy getting the phone call or the information in the mail, the sweepstakes. And if they didn't, they wouldn't market that particular way. And I know there are stories and there are criticisms and valid criticisms in this case of sweepstakes. There is legislation, and I can't tell you that this legislation will pass Congress. Senate Bill 335 has been reported out of the Committee on Government Affairs and evidently is ready to go to the Senate for a vote. I don't know what the outcome of that bill is going to be, but it deals with these kinds of issues. And our concern, quite frankly, is to have 50 states do 50 different things with regards to sweepstakes. For example, early on you talked about the point type, 12, 16, 18. Well, Oregon adopts 12, California 18, whatever the case may be, And now you're in violation unless you have literally, if each state does something different, 50 different pieces of mail going out to the various constituents, residents in each state. There's some language about removal from the list, a demand or request to have your name removed. Our suggestion is 4 months, because it does take some time with computers and people to do those kinds of things. One state may be 3 months. Well, again, then you have to develop each of the information differently for California and Oregon, and we think there should be uniformity, and we think Congress should deal with it. But it appears as though this bill has some legs, and that's why we're willing to work and happy to work with the sponsors and the Attorney General's office to see if we can work out some language that works. But again, our hope is that Congress can step forward, and they appear to be stepping forward because of the reasons that the sponsors have talked about, the criticism of some of the sweepstakes and how they are run. And again, I think it's much better to do this on a national basis than state by state. So with that, I will be quiet, and if you have any questions, Your Honor, I'd be happy to
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
I would agree with you. But how to get that done?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, I don't know what the fate of the legislation is going to be, but if the bill comes out of committee, it suggests to me that there are a lot of legs in the United States Congress to move something forward, that this is an issue that has come to the forefront. But I can't, as I was talking with Mr. Shepard, he said, well, it's not law. And I agree it's not law, and I don't know when or where this is going to happen, but I think that's the best way to go. I don't know if Mr. Powell is going to talk about a personal situation, and I don't know if it demands this level of attention in Oregon if we can do something nationally. Now, it's easy for me to say wait 2 years, but I suggest that you should wait 2 years.
Mr. Chair? Another question. Mike, do the companies realize what they're doing to older people?
Mr. Chair,
maybe not a fair question.
And Senator Duncan, I really can't answer that because I cannot get into the mind of the folks that put the various sweepstakes together.
But in this room right now, we're just common people. Suggest that there's something wrong.
Well, and Senator Duncan, I understand where you're coming from, but I would suggest that the vast majority of sweepstakes are online. There's disclosure. There's enough information to make a decision as to whether or not you want to move forward. Buy the magazine, whatever the case may be. I play golf, and so I get a lot on the golf side of the equation. And I look at those, and I say to myself, those are pretty upfront, and I can understand what that's all about. Publishers Clearinghouse has been around for a long, long time, and there's been some criticism of that, and I think they've rectified that based upon what has happened with the Attorney General across the United States. So they have their group that's working on this also. But again, I think I would say that most of these organizations, be it a telemarketer, sweepstakes, whatever the case may be on the mail side, it's probably not in their best interest to over and over again be a bad actor business-wise.
But
I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
But they have been, and they seem to continue to be. I mean, you hear stories all of the time. Of people, older people who keep sending things in, or they get all the excitement. It's almost scary that some of the things that happen. We wait for something or do we take some action?
Well,
I don't think we can be just tolerate it. That's where I recognize where you're coming from.
Well,
you work for them, but
this is a difficult one for me to say because you have some elderly people. And the question is whether or not some can comprehend the information. can read it in such a way that a reasonable person would understand that they have not won, based upon the verbiage. Now, if there are four or five people that have done something reacted to that, as opposed to, we'll just say, 99% of the population understood it, at what point do we act? And by and large, it's a small, I would suspect, and I don't have any of the information that the AG would have in terms of the people that have been misled, disadvantaged by the, let's say, the sweepstakes. Clearly, people enjoy sweepstakes. We would not have them if that were not the case. And I have no problem with having some guidelines in terms of the point type, disclosure, did you win or not win, how many phases, all of those types of regulations are in the Senate bill in Congress. But they differ slightly from this particular bill.
Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Peter P. Powell, also known as TP. I am in front of you. Actually, my name is John Powell. I'm here representing myself. As Mr. Dewey had indicated, I did have an experience along this line with my mother. In part, I think one of the reasons Representative Deckard introduced this bill was a discussion we had during the interim. After that discussion, he found out that somebody that he, an acquaintance of his, was also having a problem. I think the answer to this dilemma is slow but deliberate action, and not trying to think that we can suddenly pull the rabbit out of the hat, if you will, to solve this problem, because it's a very difficult one to solve, because I've looked at it and did not have the time in the interim due to the illness of my mother to spend enough time on the issue. But I did run into several constitutional problems along the way in trying to find a solution. So it does take some care and deliberations. At the same time, as Mr. Dewey points out, many of these marketing techniques work in a very traditional way. If you go into a supermarket and places like that, you see displays. I enjoy a certain soft drink downstairs, and you take the cap off and you turn it over and see if you won a vehicle. I never win, but I always turn it over. And I do not buy the soft drink to have a chance of winning a Volkswagen, because that would just make me pay taxes. But bottom line is something needs to be done in discussions. And I was just sitting here thinking, you know, maybe an SJR or a resolution to Congress for the first time in my 24 years in this building would be have some meaning. Maybe you could actually send one of those things to Washington, D.C. on a bill and have it have some impact. Most of those things I've seen in my history have just kind of, I think, floated around and that sort of thing. But one of the things you might consider is actually either individually with your letterhead or in terms of a resolution actually supporting this kind of legislation on a national basis, because the issue does need to be resolved nationally. The bill before you, and I'd be glad to sit down with Mr. Dewey as well and talk about the problems created by some of the requirements. This bill does not really get at the magazine sweepstakes, which were the problem in my mother's case, because this language requires that you have to buy something. If you look at line 16, the definition of sweepstakes, it includes any such procedure in which a person is required to purchase anything, pay anything of value, that sort of thing. So, and then down below it says, well, if it's leading or misleading, that you maybe if you buy something, your chances are better. I don't think that does anything because of a federal court case that recently came down just before the end of the year, in which the court said Well, if you really read this stuff, and you really read the fine print and spend enough time on it, a reasonable person would conclude you didn't win. So it gets to the point that really the reasonable person test really doesn't work, I don't think. And I don't think it's going to work in the courts. Because there's not that many unreasonable people. One of the things that happened when the attorney generals around the country started bringing legal action against these companies for misleading consumers is that magazine sales as a result of these have plummeted. I mean, there have been dramatic, like 25% decreases in magazine sales from these sources as a result of the litigation and these people softening their marketing approach. So it shows you that a lot of people do believe if we order magazines, maybe our envelope will go into a better pot for this drawing. Now, that may not be true, but I think they believe that. In my mother's case, it was a marketing scheme whereby you were offered jewelry, which was beyond worthless. And the jewelry was a prize, but included with it was a come-on that you would get it mounted and then a necklace or something like that for $29.95. And she was one of these who had a drawer full. Just a huge drawer full. And I said, one day, and we didn't know it at the time, but she was suffering from Alzheimer's. And I said, Mom, what are these boxes? And she says, well, someday I'm going to have a garage sale. And she had justified it, I think, in her mind that someday she'd get her money back. But she really, I think, thought someday she'd leave her children some great inheritance by winning this prize, the grand prize of some sort. So, I think this has to be done one step at a time. And not think that we can revolutionize the world, but just go slow and steady. I think the marketing companies eventually will be happy with two-thirds of the business they had when they were using some of these other tactics. And again, I'm not one that would say we should ban sweepstakes, jackpots, those sorts of things, but it has to be clearer to the consumer what they're getting into and what these tactics lead to. And again, I think we can do it step by step. This bill or part of this bill can be one of those steps. Again, I don't think it gets us there totally, but I think we can work on it.
Sure.
John, I'm wondering if you do the step-by-step, how long is it going to take? And the people we're talking about are being hurt right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if we pass something like this, if we don't send a message, just one state, of course, but one, maybe another state we'll be looking at. But maybe it's a message to the direct advertising, and I'm not opposed to it. And for the people who want to have fun, I don't have any trouble with that. I'm looking at the people, like your mother and
sure.
An aunt of mine and some people from my own church. But maybe we get maybe this sends a real message, much more so than even some joint resolution would send. I mean, this is a message to them that states are trying to do something. And it would make them get their house in order.
Sure.
And I know we could get the argument. I understand what Mike's saying about 14 point in one state and 12 point in another state. Hey, that's going to... Maybe they're going to start doing something so states won't have to do that. I don't know.
If I may just comment, looking at the bill that was reported out May 20th, if this were to move forward, there is the... this particular act. So a local law or state provision is not preempted. So that's why we would prefer not to have each state move in that direction. If it was a preemption, that would be a different story. We'd be all over this because we'd have the same rules everywhere.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I think one of the things we might do, and I have not looked at this federal legislation, is this little informal work group that we'll have with Mr. Shepard. Perhaps we can look at that bill and see if there isn't some way to kind of dovetail some of what we're trying to do with the federal legislation so that it does kind of match what they've done there.
Hey, Carlo. Gentlemen, I appreciate your effort and everything else, but if there's something I can do to make this thing go forward, I want to do it. I've got too many complaints myself. I guess I'm elderly. And that's the question I have for Mr. Shepard. We don't have a definition of what elderly is. Is it Duncan? Is it Carno? Or is it Courtney? What is elderly? But I would like a definition of that, Mr. Chair, and I feel pretty strong about this thing. Thanks.
I really like to see this come out with something this time. I think I agree. Nothing more than a strong message to the companies because they're acting on it.
Well, we'll meet and see what we can do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3388. Open the public hearing on 36. Denalda, Dotson.
Oh,
we have. What? That's
in
the room. Just a minute, folks. Hold it. Reopen the hearing on 3388. Bill. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Philip Fell from Portland, Oregon. I'm appearing here as an individual, despite the fact I work for the League of Oregon City. In October of last year, I received a call from a cousin who lives in suburban D.C. that our dear Aunt Betty at 81 had just gotten an eviction notice from the fire marshal. Why? Well, Aunt Betty hadn't actually cleaned a whole lot since her husband died about 15 years ago. And we had 1 month to get it cleaned up to their satisfaction, or else she would be evicted from the building. Several cousins from around the United States gathered. Over the course of 1 week, we took 5.5 tons of stuff out of her apartment. I would guess that 60% of that was magazine subscriptions. I couldn't dig in any pile without finding a picture of Ed McMahon. Furthermore, after getting tired of it and slipping on, I think, a 2-year pile of the Biblical Archaeological Review, I decided to look at the advertising and see exactly what it was that Aunt Betty was doing. Well, it took me forever to discover that she hadn't really won. I mean, there were little gold stars on several different sheets of paper. There were several mailings. She was absolutely convinced that the more magazines she bought, the better chance she had of winning $1 million. I would certainly agree that Aunt Betty is dotty, shall we say. I think a lot of other people are as well. I think you've all heard about this from your own constituents. I feel that my aunt was absolutely taken advantage of. And I hope that you proceed with this bill. I feel like, Mr. Chair, I feel like I should also apologize to the previous speakers if there's anything I hate at someone hopping in when they don't have an organizational dog in that fight. I'd like to again reemphasize that I'm appearing as an individual who spent 5 days in a pilot.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, how did your aunt deal with you folks?
Outraged. She was outraged that we were cleaning all this up. She didn't want to make sure we didn't throw a single publisher's clearinghouse letter away.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Okay. I'm going to close here. 3388, open it up.
That's the 3638, Alda. The Alda Dotson case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melda Dyson. I'm an assistant administrator of the Oregon Health Division. I'm here to provide you some information about making the WIC program into statute and so that it resides within the Health Division of the Department of Human Resources, and so that we can adopt rules to impose civil penalties as described in this bill. WIC is a nutrition education program. Many of you probably already know about it. It's a program for women, infants, children up to the age of 5. It provides food and nutrition education and adjunctive health services for about 94,000 people in our state on a monthly basis. We also provide contracts and work with over 600 grocers or vendors within our state. And it's important that we look at putting WIC into statute so that WIC will be able to comply with some recent federal regulations that have just come down and be able to impose these civil penalties. If we do not do this, then we may be in we will be in violation of our federal requirements for that program. WIC currently provides like food vouchers for foods such as eggs, milk, cereal, cheese, and each one of these little food vouchers is worth about $35. This ability to levy civil penalties would be for us to really impose a penalty against a vendor who may be trafficking in these food vouchers. And when we're talking about severe trafficking, like using food instruments for buying arms, drugs, those types of things. Currently, we do sanction employers or vendors, but we can't sanction them with a money penalty. This would allow us to do that. The intent of the regulations is to help us curb vendor-related fraud. It's also to give us an opportunity to work with these vendors. For example, if a store owner has a store someplace else, and this happens with the utilization of the WIC vouchers, currently that store owner only has one option. We go in and we sanction them, and we can pull their certification to do WIC voucher redemption. This allows us to say we can impose a civil penalty in lieu of that, especially in cases where this may be the sole source vendor, like in Christmas Valley or Illinois Valley or some of those where there's only small vendors available to the population. So this gives us more opportunities to work with the providers of services in these communities. I just wanted to give you a summary of this and again emphasize that we need to have this in statute, and our compliance timeline is October of 99.
Okay, are there some questions? I understand we're going to, this will come back Tuesday at 7:30.
That's in the morning.
Well, I just want to be okay. Just people should start to get ready for 7:30 judiciary committee meetings. We're shifting, dramatically shifting our time because two of the members are in this clandestine, secret, mysterious meeting that's going on in the building. The site house spent $11 billion.
Sure. Quick question.
Yes.
Does this require an emergency clause because of the time frame imposed on WIC?
That's a good. I mean,
does this require an emergency clause because of the time frame imposed on WIC?
Bill, does it or does it not? Do you like that? Here's the question from Senator.
I heard the question. I don't understand the question.
Oh. The effect of this bill would be that this would take effect on or well. I mean, I could be optimistic and say about October 4th, if in fact and what they're asking is whether or not
that would be okay.
The effective date would need to be earlier than that.
Why would you like to go for an emergency clause?
Well, what it does is bring the case effect immediately upon the governor's signature. Excuse me?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission committee. Yes, I think we would need an emergency clause. And we could be out of compliance with federal regs, but our federal regulations do say October 1 of 99.
And I suggest
that you put one in. So that's what that's all about. So what are we saying there? It's really confused with this. Very good point.
Did you make that point? Well, if you're bad for you.
I see. That's pretty good.
Yes.
We should be done. We should be gone.
No, thank you, and thank you for waiting so patiently. I'm sorry that, well, if my game plan had worked, we wouldn't have had to wait so long, but people are, if they let me, then I won't be doing that. Is that it? Yes, ma'am, you guys would not let me do two public hearings at the same time on two separate bills, otherwise I'd have been too soon.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Public knowledge, but I thought that the coverage of the church lady was absolutely excellent this recent meeting. Do you have a chance to see it? And she's in the audience, and I just thought we ought to publicly acknowledge it.
You know who the church lady is?
Yes, they didn't go through that.
Picture on the front page.
Name's Ellen Lowe.
Well, I know
her. Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you get the article?
She's been coming. I think
so. Did you get the article?
Oh, I read
it. Did you get in the article?
Did you see all the pictures?
Excuse me. Did you get in the article?
I think I mentioned on the front.
Oh, page. Well, now I know why. I know why you wanted to talk about it. Okay, I don't think anybody else wants to justify anything. Is someone else trying to have a 3630 to impose the public hearing 3630? That's it, right? We're done today.
I want to thank both my senators and fellow senators for coming because we were able to do at least the public hearings, which